Dentistry is changing. Technology, education, and resources are closer to our fingertips now more than ever. Are you ready to learn what millennial dentists are doing to exceed patient expectations, enjoy dentistry more, and take more vacations? Or how this generation can join up with the previous ones to make for an unstoppable dental team? Well, wait no longer. Here are your hosts of The Millennial Dentist, Dr. Holsinger, Dr. Payray, and Dr. Sully Sullivan.
Hi, welcome back, everybody, to the Millennial Dentist Podcast.
Season two.
It has been way too long. I feel like we have not recorded in weeks.
It's been a while, and that's why I was nervous driving here, because I was like, man, we haven't done this in about, what, 8 weeks?
Well, I am expecting a baby any day now. Wow. In fact, I could get a call during this, and I might have to jet.
How about your wife? Is she expecting also?
She's expecting. I guess she's
trying. Hopefully.
I act like I'm doing all this work, and it's so stressful for me. But she's the one that I guess is carrying the baby. So that's exciting. But yeah, it's just been a crazy fall. But you've been killing it.
But I love the fact because I've been following, of course, with. But let's go ahead and start.
Let's jump in.
Yeah, let's just go ahead and
introduce our guests.
I'm very lucky and blessed. We have Dr. Michael Picos with us today.
Doc, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be a part of this.
We're super excited to have you.
First time you told me that you're going to have him, I'm like, no, shut up. He's not going to come.
Well,
like,
it took us a lot to get together. We got together.
It's just a year.
It's been a year. We're trying to put this up.
But hey, schedules are hard to get by.
It is, especially with his schedule. I know that he's been all over the new symposium, the PICOS. This is the third year,
fourth year.
And you're doing it most of the time around this time?
Correct. Yeah, it's October, November, pretty much. We've pretty much settled into the same venue, you know, the Ritz-Carlton, Orlando. Right. We've been going there, guys, for about 16 years now, roughly, you know, with my collaboration with Maurice Salama and Partners in Synergy. We pretty much zeroed in on that particular hotel, and it's been fun.
Nice hotel.
It's been closer to maybe 8-9 years at that hotel, but in Orlando, we've been going there, other hotels prior to that for another few years. But long and short of it is we love that particular Ritz, and this actual symposium that I've now been doing on a yearly basis, we just completed the fourth one. Yeah.
Nice.
And for whatever reasons, I'll tell you, it was the most fun for me, for my team. Our group did a great job. And most impressively, we had an unbelievable lineup of speakers.
Absolutely.
And, just over 280 attendees.
Nice.
I'll tell you, at this venue, I mean, at this point, time of the year, AAP was going on at the same time, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we're tickled pink to have that kind of, you know, that those numbers. But most impressively is every speaker just did a bang-up job. I mean, very well received. The feedback we got each day, I mean, at the break, at lunch, was pretty much the same thing. Like, thanks so much for doing this. We appreciate it. Because, you know, the bottom line is, as you guys know me well enough, I like to cut to the chase. And my charge with each of the speakers always is they're given an hour and 40 minutes to talk about you know, particular area of expertise. But most importantly is I tell them, look, this needs to be clinically relevant and evidence-based. And that may sound a little trite, but the reality is a lot of talks end up being that.
Sure.
So that said, they stick to that, and they've got an hour and 40 minutes to talk, and then 20 minutes of Q&A focused directly on them, which means while they're speaking, our attendees can certainly text questions to our iPad. And the moderator, in 20 minutes, bam, bam, bam. And I'll tell you what, we get a lot of questions answered. So it's a focused 2 hours for each speaker. So two speakers in the morning, two in the afternoon for 3 days, plus a few workshops up front. I tell you what, our 40, 41 exhibitors were all ecstatic about everything.
Sure.
There was just such a buzz, an energy that it's just hard to explain, hard to describe. So it was just the best I think we've done yet.
While we're talking about it, we also got to bring in our other special guest.
Yes,
we brought in Dad, Dr. Rick Sullivan's back on the show. Welcome back,
Dad.
Show.
Yes,
good to be here. You know, and frankly, it would be not fitting to not have him on for one reason. That the first time I met Dr. Picos and I went down there, Dad and I went together, and then within the past year, you've completed
all four courses all and four the symposium courses. This weekend.
And you were at the symposium this weekend. While we're on the docket.
And I've registered for Dr. Urban, Dr. Pico's February, and already pre-registered for next year's symposium.
So, Dad, you got to tell us a little bit then about
why we want to hear about this weekend. Make you, yeah, tell us, well, how did you getting like to get to go all of it in this time for you as far as how what made you go after the first one, I guess, because you guys both went together. And tell us, what was the first one that you went in that you went?
So we started last year in October. Sally and I went to the advanced bone grafting course, which is 4 days. And I had to leave a little bit early that Saturday because my daughter's water broke for our first
remember.
Grand child. Yeah. And so I had to change. And all week long, it was like, well, I make it to the next day because I had to go with the promise that I would get on a plane if something happened. So I made it to the last day. It was so impactful that I just felt like, you know, I've done this 31 years. Mm-hmm. And so many times it's so easy to go to the first course of one of these continuums or the second. And I knew me, if I went ahead and just signed up, booked the times and said, I'm going to do this, I would do it. And I will tell you, not just because you're here, but, you know, it was some of the best money and some of the hands down the best CE mm-hmm. I've had. I've come back and probably at least tripled my investment, if not quadrupled my investment. Already.
Boom.
Well, great news. Great to hear.
You know, and I'm, you know, it's stuff that I've brought back every Monday. I mean, I was texting one of my periodontists Sunday because I needed some BioOS because we were out and I had three teeth extraction anterior case this Monday morning that I came in and I did a bone mill that we talked about this weekend. I did the sandwich graft.
I loved it.
I did the pin.
He was just throwing. Look at this.
I literally had the entire everything.
It was like, I was like, how much more are you going to put in there?
But, you know, it was one of those cases that needed it all. And I'm expecting great results.
Well, the big thing for me, and Doc, this is partly where I want to get a little bit of your, I want to really dive into some, through this kind of conversation, a little bit of like your early days and kind of how you got to be doing.
Yeah, so that's
doing.
Fun. Actually, yeah. You said that because we started from the weekend, but we want to now go back about 45 years.
Yeah, wait a minute now.
45 years.
Back to when they were doing stuff. We don't even, because yeah. It starts to me with when, you know, you realize very quickly we realized, hey, you could get an implant a stick. You could do this, mm-hmm. You know, but then we talk about this all the time, how, you know, it's so much harder to restore them, to put them in the right position, to worry about soft tissue. There's so much more that goes on to it. And so you have to keep doing continuing mm-hmm. education.
Right.
But how did it all start for you, Doc?
Sure. That's a great question. You know, it's interesting. I've just finished my 35th year of practice. So wow. If we go back to...
So not 40. He's not that old. Saying,
I always wanted to go back to high school.
Okay, go back.
I wanted to know. Okay, so dentistry. Just like why did you even choose dentistry? All right,
well, I've got a unique story. I actually wanted to be a petroleum engineer. Believe it or not, out of high school. It's a long story, but in fact, I went to Colorado College, which is a liberal arts school. I almost went to the Colorado School of Mines. I was accepted there.
Wow.
Out of high school, but decided not to, and it was just as well. So the long and short is, after being at Colorado College, and I was there because the summer before, as an NSF scholarship student, I was one of 30 kids that got to spend the summer there. So I thought it was kind of cool. And but once I got there, I said, you know what, geology is not for me, not at all. And ended up transferring to West Virginia University, believe it or not. My uncle was a priest at the time in Morgantown, and I thought, well, I could stay with him, save money on room and board, et cetera. And I got into pre-med at that point and was intrigued. You know, biological sciences was really always my forte. So spent a year there and then realized I could come back in state and even save more money. And actually, the archdiocese transferred him out to a parish in California. So I ended up at Ohio State for the next 3 years. And pre-med, got into 4 or 5 med schools, ended up at St. Louis University, and I wanted to be a pediatrician, believe it or not. And I saw a few kids die that first year as a preceptorship thing.
Right, yeah.
It flipped me out. It really did.
Wow.
It put me into a tailspin, and I took a leave of absence. I was going to just quit, and the dean wouldn't let me quit. He gave me a leave, which, as it turned out, was a blessing, because then after a couple years of just getting away from everything, getting my head clear, and just, I mean, you know, I had cranked my brains out, you know, valedictorian high school, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa college, all that good stuff. But I was pretty much burned realizing that what my dream was about wasn't going to happen because I just wanted away from everything, medicine, sure, all that. So long story short, after getting into some sales work, door-to-door sales, believe it or not, it's crazy.
No way. Selling, yeah. Dr. Selling. Mike Pica is a door-to-door salesman.
I was a shy son of a gun, believe it or not, but that pulled me out of my, you know, what have you, because, sure, hey, I needed to make money. I'm back in Columbus feeling sorry for myself, trying to figure out what am I going to do. And I answered this blind ad, and sure enough, it's sales. But I was one of about 35 folks that showed up for this meeting, dressed up, you know, suit and tie, the whole bit. And one by one, everybody started leaving when I realized it was sales. And me, out of courtesy to the speaker, I'm the last Mohican. Nobody, you know, standing. Nobody else was there but me. And I got so bought into what they were, you know, doing with this Cutco cutlery. I said, I'm going to buy this damn kit. I'm never going to sell, but I love it, and I'm going to use it myself. For $175, I bought it. And long story short, I ended up selling it and getting 10% commission on my on 10 guys under me and 40% my own commissions, blah, blah, blah. Everybody said, wait a minute, time out. I'm making great money, but I need to get back to school. And then it was elimination. What do I do with my life? Law? Nah, no aptitude. Went right down the list. Dentistry just seemed like a logical, you know, it would work. I mean, biological sciences, people still like medicine, etc. So, you know, that's it. I applied to one school, and that was my undergrad program, you know, University, Ohio State. And that was a trip. That interview, I'll never forget it. There were four guys, and one was a neurosurgeon who gave me a lot of crap, a lot of static. Why did you leave? Why do you want dentistry? Why did you leave? He asked me three times. By the third time, I was going to reach across the table and choke him. And then he looks down and he goes, well, it looks like you haven't completed your studies for application here to the dental school. And I looked at him and said, excuse me? You know, I got into these four med schools. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he says, well, it's simple. You didn't finish your second undergraduate, I mean, your second lab course in organic chemistry. I said, well, there's a reason for that. I got in early at these med schools, and before I made my choice of where I wanted to go, I asked all of them, can I substitute biochemistry for organic lab too? As soon as I said that, he slammed his fist down like Khrushchev. Bam, I jumped about 2 feet like a circus act. He goes, this is not medical school. This is the Ohio State University College of Dentistry, blah, blah, blah. And you will take organic lab too, or you cannot even begin to apply here. So guess what? After 2+ years removed, I had to go back, take second organic lab. It was a ball buster. But I did it. There is history. And once in dental school, because of my sales experience, no kidding.
So you went back to the organic lab too to finish after the couple years?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it was a major pain in the butt to give up, you know, working and what have you. And just, plus just the thought of going back to organic lab too, you know. But anyway, I never worked hard in my life for a B. But I got it, and the rest is history. So once in dental school, surgery seemed kind of cool. I did an internship at the Valley Hospital, which was very surgical-based, and loved it. I mean, I got my hands in everything I could possibly get, 24/7 cadaver labs, name it. And then subsequently went on to surgery in University of Pittsburgh at Montefiore Hospital. And from there, direct shot down here to the Tampa Bay area because my father was born and raised here.
How did you know you wanted to, what made you decide to go the surgery route versus like when you were, I mean, is that something you knew from the get-go you wanted to do or how did that come about?
Would you do it right now?
Internship. Oh yeah, absolutely. I'd do it all over again. In fact, looking back, I'm glad I left medicine. That was the best move of my life because I kept in touch with some of my buddies from med school their first year. And boy, I tell you what, one by one, they had to retire early. Those that went into general surgery, et cetera. Medicine changed so much that they had to retire in their 50s. They just weren't making much money. Rules change, and you know the story. Got goofed up badly. So for me, it was that internship that really turned me on because it was so surgically based. It just seemed like this is fun. I enjoy doing this. I actually enjoyed all of dentistry. I was very close to going into ortho, to be honest. But that internship did the trick.
That's what
and I haven't looked back.
Yeah. We always, Kevin, we talk a lot of times, and I'd love to get your opinion too, because it's kind of, I guess, on topic at this point in the conversation is, you know, so many young dentists now ask us, are we glad, you know, because both, Pamela and I are both general dentists who do a lot of surgery stuff and like to do surgery, You know, they ask a lot of times, you know, is it still worth going to all these residencies? You know, now we have such good continuing education as a general dentist that you're able to do a lot of stuff and get the education you can get without having to go to 4 or 5 years more of school. What's kind of your take on that? Because, I mean, I'm sure you see it in your classes even. I mean, you're getting more and more general dentists probably than even periodontists and oral surgeons half the time now. And that's just, I mean, kind of a question we get a lot, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think part of it mostly is because they are not really interested in surgery. And that's the big point, because it's not really, they're not really fascinated by doing the oral surgery per se. They're like
the implants,
the luxury of implant dentistry that makes the money. I think it's one of those to where people start doing them. And then after a while, they're like, I really don't even care about raising a flap. I just want to use a guide. I'm like, you don't really like this stuff.
That's true.
So I think it's the results they're looking after instead of the whole process of learning the surgical aspect. And that's the wrong reason for a lot of those folks, I think. But regarding surgery, I think that's something where I don't think with any CE you can learn like the big stuff they do. So that's, I think most of that questions come related to the people that are just really interested in doing implants, not really all that whole trauma and surgical stuff.
Well, sure. And I would agree. I think there's pro and con to what you said in terms of, you know, is it worth going an additional 3 or 4 years for a residency, specifically say oral surgery or even perio, for example.
Sure.
You know, there's no question that there's rewards for that, definitely. But I think the neat thing in terms of, for example, all three of you being restorative based, but yet surgically trained, are able to do pretty much everything under one roof yourself and control that from A to Z. And, you know, Carl Misch talked about that years ago when I hooked up with him late 80s and into the early 90s, took all of his courses. I audited pretty much everything, but then went back and took the prost at least 3 different times, bringing a group of my restorative dentists each time, like 5 or 6 up to Dearborn, had him come down a few times, et cetera, et cetera. But Carl called this way back and said that there's no question that the one who really drives everything, of course, is the restorative dentist. And as we know, this discipline is heavily restorative based and driven for sure. And he would talk about that from the get-go and tell us the same thing, that, look, I have this advantage. You know, I'm restorative-based, but I do my own surgery. And I realized that. I did. And I felt that I was kind of at a loss or at a disadvantage. So that's why I actually, of my more than 5,000 hours of CE and counting today, more than, I would say, 40-50% of that is restorative-based.
Wow.
CE, believe it or not. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoy the restorative element. I can thank Carl for that big time. God rest his soul. And I think it's imperative for a surgical specialist to really have a handle on the restorative element so that we in turn can provide, you know, our restorative base with implants placed in the right position, certainly. But even more than that is being able to appreciate the hard and, of course, the soft tissue element. And as I've been preaching for years, and that's at the heart of my institute, is becoming a hybrid dentist, as you guys know. Mm. You know, that's important to me, that we develop skill sets equal in bone and soft tissue. And any of us that can do that, I mean, the sky's the limit. Are you kidding? And, you know, and of course, you have the restorative element and skill set already. So then you've got the whole enchilada. To me, that's the ultimate. But that said, it's critical, and I preach this all the time in my courses, wherever I'm lecturing, that we all need to know how to draw that proverbial line in the sand and know that we need to stay there and see Dr. Gosser or Dr. Bruno. I know you can do it. You kind of get that factor going before you're doing it, and then you get into some trouble, et cetera. My point is, we're all, I've said this forever, we're all one piece from never practicing, depending on your state board.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's important that we know our limitations is what I'm saying. Whether you're a specialist or a generalist, it doesn't matter. We all have limitations.
Absolutely. It's, you know, one of the things is, I don't know if you can hear us or you can see us.
Yes, I can hear you, sure.
One of the things that I never forget is getting out of school and getting in the opportunity to go and see Dr. Picos in Tampa at such a young age of 27, 26, I was right at, and saw the whole magnitude of what he had built over the years, but also seeing that part of where he has everything so organized in such a way that it was the, like, I was just kept that whole week that I was there. I was just saying, like, thank God, I'm so lucky to see this, because it kind of showed me what could be the side of dentistry, that if you're passionate, if you really love what you do, look at what he done and then look at it. And then ever since then, I just always even tell my staff. So, like, for example, I have a videographer now in my office that he just takes videos of my cases. Like, I do voiceover after. And all of those things really came from just coming to the course and seeing that how the cases that he was showing was going back to years and years ago that he had followed up. And I'm like, man, this guy, like, is so legit. And, like, me not knowing. So then I kept coming back and learning more and more, to where everybody's like, what are you doing? And what is Dr. Pico's writing on your wall? On Facebook. And so it's been an incredible mentorship. Like, even though without you knowing, I really look up to people like you, Dr. Coises, and like Dr. Carl Misch, rest in peace. But it's really blessing for us young people to see them at such a young age, to be able to kind of see what is possible. And especially, like, with the whole technology that's out there, using that kind of skills that you learn with these folks and and you do the whole thing too. You do the whole surgical guide course of all on four type of restorative care. That's one of the courses that you offer. So it's very impressive to, after all of these years, he's going back to now changing his system. You say something always that I remember. You said something about every 3 years, if everything that I tell you, go ahead and say, yeah.
Yeah, the half-life, I used to say 3 years, believe it or not, the half-life of our, what I call non-core material. You know, core is anatomy, things like that obviously change. But our non-core material, I used to say 3 years was the half-life, which meant if you were here now, for example, for the week, that roughly 3 years from now, 50% of what we talk about is obsolete. Well, guess what? That number has been reduced a year and a half barely. It's scary. But the good news is, and you just said so nicely, the technology is available to us now. And I envy you young folks, especially you guys, because you're able to take advantage of what we didn't have before. Meaning, you know, 24/7, you can look at a video. If you're up 2 a.m, you can't sleep, you know, why not just get up and, you know, instead of just pacing and tossing and turning, open up your iPad and you know, have at it. My point is, you've got access 24/7 to virtually anything you need to learn and know, period. And that's good and bad. Of course, you've got to be able to use discretion and draw the line there. Otherwise, your spouse will, you know, take off on you. You know how that game goes. I've been accused of all sorts of things when I had my iPad under my pillow. So I had to get rid of that game. But my point is, I do envy you folks, because you have taken advantage of not just the technology, but you've taken my course, others, and most importantly, you've implemented the information, the knowledge. There are a number of folks that take my courses, like others, and they don't implement. And if you don't implement, it just doesn't happen. The longer you're away from it, it just for sure won't happen. The odds are. That's why I tell everybody, Monday morning, look at that action list and at least
make it happen.
Make it happen. One or two things at a time, but make it happen and continue to. You're not going to learn it all, no way, but like a cafeteria style thing, pick what you are comfortable doing and do it, and then continue to and build on those fundamentals. And that's, look, for all of us, I still take about 130 hours a year of CE. I mean, bona fide CE, not sign in, you know, go to the beach and all that nonsense. No, it's sign in, front row, tape recorder, you know, the whole bit. You know, you've got to keep learning. And I admire you three for doing that, because you're proof of concept.
We are all CE junkies.
Well, and that's what our I think the true key to our success has been. I mean, if you look back, I mean, especially for me and you, the reality is like we're silly to reinvent the wheel. I mean, when we go to like Dr. Pico's lectures and you see, you know, these cases that are 30 years old that he's telling us about and showing us 25-year follow-ups. And Dad, the same way. I mean, like when we see the stuff he does and talks about, you know, from a restorative standpoint or whatever it is, you know, so that's something I think that we lean on so much is that, gosh, whether it's online, whether it's someone in person, whether it's the dentist that you work with or the dentist on the street, having good mentors and just being a sponge at our age is so invaluable to our success and whatnot. So, Doc, while moving kind of on to you know, we kind of went on that tangent for a minute there. I want to hear, you know, now you're working in your practice. You know, it would be easy to just be a successful oral surgeon and do a lot of stuff. What kind of has made you want to be on the leading edge of researching things and then educating and how did that all even begin?
Mm-hmm. Question. What? That's a great question, Sully. I'll tell you, you know, I never envisioned myself being in this role as an educator as well as a clinician. I just did not. If you'd asked me that in my first years of practice, I'd have said, "Now you're out of your mind. There's no way I'm even think about doing that. Are you kidding?" So what happened is it was late 80s, 89, I think 90, right in there, where Tom Ford, God rest his soul as well, from Orlando, restorative dentist that was in implant dentistry quite a bit. And I started practicing from 83 forward. And in the 80s, it was either Jerry Nisnik's Corvent system or Nobel, or Brandemark rather, at that time. And I chose to go with Jerry. So because of that, Tom Ford and I became friends. And Tom was an educator at the time as a restorative-based dentist, doing his own surgery. And the long and short of it is he was short a surgical colleague to teach one of his courses that he was doing in Orlando. And he called me up frantically saying, "Mike, you know, my good buddy from Chicago is ill, and I know he won't be able to make it next month, blah, blah, blah. Could you fill in?" And I just froze on the other end of that phone like, "Are you kidding?"
Wow.
I said, "Tom, what am I supposed to do? How? I don't even know where to begin." And he said, "No, don't worry." He said, "I've got all the slides. You know, it's basically, you know, you're already doing this stuff. It's a matter of teaching, you know, step how to place implants, et cetera, et cetera." And it started that way. So I did the course, and I can't tell you how many, for the month, I was up like almost 24/7 trying to figure out what the best way to, you know, approach it. And that was the old days with slides.
Yeah.
So I did it, and I kind of got hooked. I got hooked. I can't begin to say how it just got into my blood, how it became fun to, when you saw the attendees were so excited about it, and I was excited doing it. My first implant was in 1983 after only doing Dr. Small's implants, the staple bone plates where we make incisions, you know, under the chin and put this plate up. It had literally pins going through the bone. Wow. And two of them would make it into the arch. It was a horrible scenario because your tissues would flame, etc. But the implant, I mean, it was 99% bulletproof for whatever that was worth. But that's all I did. And skin graft from the butt and watching hair grow out of the mouth, wow, you know, as a resident. So that was the early years. So fast forward to 83, I started practice. I'm exposed to these Corvent implants. The first one I put in was on a major league umpire who was retired in our area. And I'll never forget it. I mean, it was 6 months buried. It was like watering it, putting fertilizer on it, making sure it's going to grow, you know, the whole bit. And at 6 months, I uncovered the damn thing. And thank God it took, because I would have been so embarrassed, I felt, in my own mind. And that was implant number one, 1983. Now, fast forward 25,000 later and counting, wow, you know, it's been a great ride, and it's been a lot of fun. But that's kind of how it started. And, you know, one thing led to another. And the educational part of it became so much fun that I told my wife, because she was about ready to shoot me, when she saw what it took for me to prepare that first, my first course. And the only reason I did the course, honest to God, I had about 8-9 buddies call up and say, "Look, you know so much. Can't you just get a bunch of us together and teach us all of this at one time?" That was my first course, like a poker game. 8-10 guys,
cool,
and upstairs of my Palm Harbor office, which is still there, and two slide, you know, carousels at a time for 2-3 days, just having at it, and that's how it started. And I told my wife, "Look, relax, I'll run out of things to say, quote unquote. This will only go for about a couple years, and I won't even know what more to say. I'll shoot my wad. That's it. It's over. Done." And well, she reminds me of that, because here it is in my 29th year, and I'll tell you what, I can't squeeze enough information into every one of my courses. I keep updating them so damn much, it drives me crazy, because I hate to look at my own stuff. My attendees would have no clue that anything's new or different, you know, or whatever, but I can't. Honestly, I feel to just, I'm just committed to staying cutting edge, practice first and foremost, because everything I do it's all that it's full, et cetera. Only then do I incorporate it into institute. I will never share an end of one or three or anything like that with anybody. I think that's very dangerous, and I respect that point too much.
Now, with you are also still involved with the school too, like academy. And wanted to kind of talk a little bit about what is the problem with the schools? I mean, other than the fact that, I mean, do you see something that could potentially help a lot of educators in the school or clinicians that are teaching the students to get in the mindset of when they leave the school, they understand that they don't know anything, or they need to kind of, or either teach them there, like, what is the whole politics in school? And I know there's a lot of politics where they, you can't fix it. And why not people like you, for example, that are outside and doing this whole everything private, why are there not more Michael Picoses in dental schools?
Well, I'll be honest, my own take on that, and it's going to be a little biased opinion, of course, but I've attempted in my own small way to help sort of change that in a few programs, but it falls on deaf ears because it seems like everybody's so entrenched in the way of doing things. It's almost like a rite of passage, you know. We went through it, so therefore these new students have to go through the same kind of thing, et cetera. Even though there's new technology, the same basic things are being taught, and a number of things are not being taught. Like, we realize, and you guys, I you know, really respect so much for many reasons, not least of which is, you know, yes, you are keeping up beautifully with CE, et cetera, but you're also younger and more privy to what should be there in the curricula. And the bottom line is, I believe that the academic guard, being what it is, they're just resistant to change in general. And it is unfortunate because I've always called dental school boot camp. It's simple. I tell all the kids that are in school, look, guys, gals, you know, when you graduate from dental school, you don't have to be dangerous. You should be doing the minimum of a GPR for sure. If you're not going on to a residency, a surgery or repair or whatever, that's fine. But do yourself a favor, do a GPR, and then your career begins to unfold as you take more CE, because if you just rest on that alone, you still won't be successful. At least you'll never see your potential. And that's the problem I have with our schools, the way they're set up, because our kids are not set up to understand that important concept. They think it's, you know, it's over. Graduate, get that diploma, and man, I can't wait to get out there and make a living. And the reality is they're not very well prepared at all. Now, what could change? I mean, definitely a number of courses could be incorporated. In fact, I would be all for a five-year program for dental school, and that, like a built-in GPR, basically, sure, where, you know, the kids really are exposed to more higher level restorative / you name it, that in occlusion that needs to be taught and understood as solid fundamentals in order to build upon the rest of their career.
Absolutely.
I have a question. Speak a little bit on those same lines to, with regards to your courses there at your institute. I think some people are intimidated that it's, you know, it's all oral surgeons, it's all specialists, it's all periodontists, especially some of these younger guys. I mean, I think it's great that Payman went at 27 and Sully went at 28 and, you know,
get exposed.
But your stuff, yeah, sure, you show some complex stuff, but really your stuff is all things that we can bring back and use Monday morning.
Mm-hmm. For soccer preservation.
Everything you've taught, I've come back and tried within a week, whether it's soft tissue, whether it's socket grafting, whether it's sinus lifts. I've not done the in sequence yet, but I've got a case, you know, I have to kind of prep for that a little bit.
Can I say this? Well,
stuff that we can use.
Yeah, in your question, I say this, and then I want you to say, because I think the short answer, he has it so easily made that a dummy can do it. Like, he's got the whole thing as far as the whole binder and folder where he's got videos, and then he shows him actually doing the surgery. Then there's also a live aspect of it where he's giving you enough. He's not one of those courses where you go in and then after you get out, you're still confused or even more confused. Because you're like, wait, I don't know if I should even attempt to do this. So I think part of it for me was just to see everything from A to Z that has been so diagrammed and so well established. Like, over, was it 91 that opened the Picos Institute? Was 91?
Yes, 1991, right? Yes, exactly. And I appreciate your comments, Payman. I do spend a lot of time in attempting to distill into the real meat and potatoes of what needs to be done on a clinical basis day to day, because I've made a career of that, and I'm proof of concept myself. And depending on one's background, you know, it will dictate how much you can take home and apply immediately. And again, I give you guys all the credit, all three of you, for implementing things so quickly, because that makes all the difference. And that's been the feedback that I've gotten from whether you're generalists or specialists. It's been the same, meaning that, wow, I didn't realize I could do this or that. And I didn't understand, you know, there's only so much you can get online and with videos.
Right.
But when there's live interaction for 3 and 4 days at a time, round the clock, and you get to see the interaction, which, as you know, I think the core, at the heart of what I'd like to express is from a Q&A standpoint, meaning throughout the entire lecture discussion time frame, I entertain questions always. I encourage them. But on top of that, we have the live surgery. We have the hands-on, et cetera. And when you look at the whole package, then yes, it makes sense, because I've distilled it, and at least I've attempted to distill everything I do in a sequential step-by-step basis. Now, I know I can make it look easy because I do it every day. And I think I'm about the only surgeon in our country that for the last, 24 years of my 35 years, I focused in one arena. I don't take out wisdom teeth. I don't do pathology, TMJ, orthognathics. I gave all that up because I wanted to focus in one area. And I've been blessed with some great associates over the years. And my current group is fantastic to afford me this opportunity to continue to focus in this one area. They do everything else within our specialty. Our daughter joined us a year and a half ago as a periodontist, and I've got now a prosthodontist on board for 2 years, Phil Hedger. So we're able to do our full arch cases literally under one roof. Anesthesia, my wife is an anesthetist. She comes in, does the anesthesia. So we've got the whole package, you know, in that sense.
Done.
And my son's coming on board, right? He's at UAB Birmingham right now, and almost halfway through his perio program, he'll be joining us. So, you know, it's been kind of cool to have the family involved. Absolutely. And that's a whole other story and discussion. But back to what you mentioned.
I'm trying to get dad to do all that so I can focus on the implants too, Doc.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. But it's been fun. And in fact, I never realized how much fun it would be to just do this stuff every single day, 24/7. It's fantastic. So because of that, I've immersed myself. And to me, I really am able, I've been blessed, because I remember as a kid distinctly a discussion that I heard. I was probably 10, 11 years old. And I recall this gentleman talking about his work at a particular office. And he said, you know, I love my work. My work is my play. I don't consider it work. It's play. And I thought, now, wouldn't that be great if that could happen to me? And guess what? It did. So, you know, I'm one of those freaks that Sunday nights, it's like, I can't wait till, thank God, you know, it's Monday kind of thing instead of Friday. I like Monday because I want to get back in the saddle and get cranking up again. And I'm still cranking 4 days a week clinically, one full day administratively. You know, I do enjoy what I'm doing immensely, but it's because I've been able to really get into this so well and understand it as best I can. But most importantly, I respect what we have to learn. It's a monumental journey for everybody. It is. But in my own simple way, I've tried to package what I've learned and continue to learn into such a system and set of a systematic manner that when I do teach, you know, I'm a slow learner. So I teach with repetition. There's a method to my madness of how I go about things. And as a result, my goal is to, yes, in fact, share what I'm doing day to day, the good, the bad, and definitely the ugly, because I'm not going to hold back and not show you my mistakes, my problems, my nightmares. You know, that's how we learn, certainly. So you got to expose yourself is what I'm saying. But in a nutshell, it's fun. I enjoy it. And yes, I do package it as best I can to make things understandable. If you're committed to learning, then you're going to learn it. And depending, again, where you're at on your learning curve, it will dictate how fast you pick it up.
Yeah,
I have a number of folks that come back. I mean, I'm the same kind of junkie. I'll take a course a couple, three times if I really like it. I'll come back periodically, see what's going on new, et cetera. And even I don't understand what's new because I see it every day. But I've had a number of folks say, geez, I was just here 3-4 years ago and man, half this stuff is different. And I don't even realize that because I'm trying to keep up as best I can and share what I'm doing. And it's an evolution. that's really, I guess, the best way to say it. It's an evolution. It's a kind of a marathon for all of us. You know, it's not a sprint kind of thing. And you do need to enjoy the journey. There is no real destination. There's no end point for us. You know, you either retire or you die, whichever comes first. And the R word is not in my vocabulary. No. My wife knows that. She would shoot me if I stayed home and tried to do the tennis, golf, fishing stuff that I enjoy. How much can you do 24/7, right?
Well, that's what I've done. I mean, literally, I've done, 100 hours with you this year.
Y'all are way too close.
It's 55 years old, and I'm already signed up. I mean, because literally every day, either Sully or I are either placing an implant, psychografting a tube,
or something around
an implant, they've become a huge part of our practice, and we're expanding it. And I've got to keep coming down there, because when he showed all those failures or the screw ups the other day on the last lecture,
yes.
I'm seeing some of my cases going, oh, this is why I got to keep coming back.
Right.
Because I don't want mine to look like that.
So, Doc, we cannot have Dr. Pigos on here and not get a little clinical. So, one thing that I would like to kind of talk about, Dad and I came, it's funny with him being down there, one of the cool things about the symposium is it's a lot of international speakers. So for us, sometimes we don't get exposed to that as much. And so Dad, I think really for the first time was exposed to so many of these, these big names in grafting and soft tissue and implant dentistry. And one of the things we discussed was how unique it is that in the US we can use, cadaver bone. We can use, allograft type materials, whereas in Europe, for instance, you can't. And so how interesting it is to see how they've come up with unique ways to be, to be able to really grow bone or, augment soft tissue, augment bone. And so I'd love to kind of hear your take on using those different types of materials and how, are we at an advantage? Are they an advantage? How do we cope and learn? Because I think it's really unique that we don't, we have that opportunity, but we're also learning a lot from what they're doing because we have it.
Yeah. Sure. And that's a very good point. And quite honestly, this is why I really take pride in handpicking these different clinicians for my symposia, and primarily from overseas, because exactly that a lot of our US folks aren't exposed to them necessarily, unless they're traveling, et cetera, and on the lecture tour. So that said, again, Rick, I think you'll be able to chime in on this, since you were just at the symposium, that, we had such an incredible cast of clinicians from overseas share their information with us and their knowledge that, yes, in fact, they can't do certain things. And that's why I brought that up during several of the Q&A sessions, meaning exactly they cannot use cadaver bone. It's off limits. They can't use BMP. It's not. It's definitely not approved as a CE mark there. So because of that, you're going to see different perspectives on how to, accomplish the same end point, but getting there differently. So, i.e., autogenous bone becomes important to them. It does. And to their credit, they've been mixing autogenous bone, as with xenografts for quite a few years, many, many years back, with the old Gore-Tex membranes that were horrible for infection, and therefore a lot of those grafts weren't working so well. And it was because the membrane, it sucked. I mean, it was bad news. It got exposed and you're dead. So fast forward, and there's different kind of membranes as we know today. The DPTFE membranes, for example, allow you to do some neat things that couldn't be done before. But the bottom line is, with no cadaver bone, you've got to get creative. So you get some biases as well. But I think at the end of the day, it's important to have a healthy respect for each other's way of doing things. So when I presented my material, I was really focusing by design more on bioengineering, tissue engineering, meaning BMP. I've got over 450 cases at 12 plus years now and counting, and those guys can't do that. So they're getting to see what I do. I in turn see what they're doing, and it's again a healthy respect for each other. In fact, that's really what got me started to think about, let's do something together, i.e. it's Von Urban and myself. And March 1st and 2nd, we will be together. And the 28th of February of next year, we'll have our workshops all day together, separate, I should say, but for the full day. And my point is, we have a healthy respect for each other, but yet, and we do a lot of things similar, but yet we have enough differences that that warrants, in my opinion, two full days of almost like a point counterpoint. You know, I use Eloderm 18 years. They can't use Eloderm, cannot. But more recently, you know, the mucograft, mucoderm stuff, et cetera, different ways of skinning a cat. You know, a lingual flap release is to get off base just for a little bit. You know, sharp dissection. You saw this one show, Beautiful Anatomy and Sharp Dissection. Well, you know, I'll tell you what, I've used the old finger, you know, for almost 30 years, 1990, doing my first subperiosteal implant. And by the way, I've got over 120 and counting still to the mandible. It's a wonderful treatment modality for these very atrophic demandibles. But my point is, blunt dissection is just my way of doing things versus sharp. Different way, that's all. Doesn't mean it's right or wrong. But again, we have a healthy respect for each other and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But back to, you know, the allografts and what have you. Yeah, we're dictated by what we can use. And fortunately, in our country, there's no holds barred. So that's good news for us. We have the luxury of being exposed to all these things and doing whatever we pick and choose that we want, would like to do.
That's pretty cool.
One thing I want to ask is to understand, especially you, because you're very visionary. Back then, you thought of all the things that you've done because you were thinking about it years ago. Now, looking forward in the future, where do you see the education, the dental education, as far as the private world, like people getting out, online world, the interaction? So there's less people keep going to these CEs more and more. So people are now coming up with, for example, these different, I don't even want to name.
Less big meetings. Like less
yeah, there's less, a lot of...
The attendance at like ADA and Midwinter and stuff like that is down.
A lot,
and
they're a lot more lower, type stuff. Right. And then these people are starting to see what is happening with the newer generation, younger, and what do you, where do you see people learning these things in the future?
That's a great question, Payman. I'll tell you, I kind of saw this coming for a number of years with regard to the lack of popularity of the quote-unquote, you know, mega or big meetings. And it makes sense because, again, the technology affords all of us the opportunity, unique opportunity, to learn in the luxury of our own house, you know, office, wherever, on the road, hotel rooms, you know, on and on. So as a result of that, doesn't mean it's going to take the place of or replace, you know, the traditional learning, but to a degree it will replace it. And that is because why would you go to a mega meeting where you've got lecture after speaker with 20, 30, 40 minutes at most showing the best things that they can do and how good they are versus what's the real teaching? And I don't mean to be at all disrespectful to anybody, and I mean that sincerely, but the reality is I've experienced it myself and I don't want to waste time at a number of these meetings either. Unless I'm speaking, I won't go. Why would I? So the bottom line is the trends loud and clear are as you just identified, and that is going to more focused meetings mm-hmm. where, you know, you have speakers that are giving you meat and potatoes for sure, and that you can interface with them. They're live, they're real, and they're not just taking off on you, you know, et cetera. But that's not in place of necessarily, but that's going to be the mainstay, and in my opinion, ongoing. You don't think that will be replaced, but the technology will get better because now we're going to soon have, actually, we already have it, but it will become more mainstream, and that is, you know, 3D learning where you know, you can, right in front of you, you know, it's all virtual basically now where we can play with any body part we want anatomically and have a way better appreciation than if we were in a cadaver lab.
Do you
how cool is that?
Any of your institute or curriculum online or have any sort of build any components into that any point in the future?
Well, it's a great question. You know, I've toyed with that. It's labor intensive, but I really think that I would like to, before I call it a day and for any reason can't function anymore, I think that I definitely would like to have a contribution online that would more or less complement what I'm still doing.
Sure.
With my courses, because I think the two of them would be great, because think about it, you could do so much work online to start, then you come down here and it's like, yeah, I've already seen it, I'm even doing some of it, but now I really can get my, you know, my claws into this thing even more so and ask more advanced kind of questions and get a better appreciation for what's going on. Mm-hmm. So well, yes, anyway, for me personally, I see an online presence definitely.
Where I think it would, where I would see it would be helpful is, because I remember the first time when I came down to advanced bone grafting, the first like morning was like drinking from a fire hose. You know, I'm out of school learning, you know, I haven't heard half these terms before. I'm just like, oh my gosh, so much good information. Yeah. And so I think I do see for sure a component where
at least the didactics to
well, and like it also kind of starts to level the playing field of like, hey, here's a foundation knowledge we want everybody to be familiar with, so that like that I could see where that could be super helpful and whatnot. But
sure, no, absolutely.
I like that at all.
So what's next for you? What is the next few? I mean, I know February is the next symposium, right? That's the very next
with Dr. Urban,
right? With the Dr. Urban's, and is that in Budapest or is it here?
No, that's back in Orlando at the Ritz-Carlton, March 1st and 2nd. And the 28th of February, we're each doing a workshop morning and afternoon. So participants will be able to do both if they so desire. And that will be so late February, early March. And then right after that, in June, I will be, again, every other year, I'm with Maurice Salama. We collaborate in that Partners in Synergy program. And then back to the fall again, and we'll be our fifth symposium, and it's every other year I'm flipping back and forth between full arch immediate reconstruction, which will be that theme for next year, and then back again in 2020 to hard and soft tissue. So literally we'll have four symposia I'll be part of within a 12-month time frame. It just kind of worked out that way this year.
What is your criteria looking at these speakers? Because I want to start getting ready. Maybe one day I get it. No, I'm kidding. What is it that you look for? Because some of those people, I have so much respect. I have their books. And that's why when I look at the list of speakers, and it's funny because you know Safa Tahmas, they're in Dubai. They had that with you with the doctor's...
Costa Nicolopoulos.
Yes. I didn't want to even attempt that.
Costa Nicolopoulos.
But I love the fact, like, what are you looking to there? Like, what is their, what are some of the things that it makes you, they've done impressive that it gets you your attention? Like, I want that guy.
Sure. That's a great question. I'll be honest. I do it quite simply on, I need to have seen them firsthand. I won't go by anybody else's. I mean, that should go without saying. You know, if you came up and said, so-and-so speaker is really good, I've got to see them first and sort of vet them, so to speak. And I think what I'm saying is that all these folks have in common one main thing, and that is they're very credible with what they do. They walk the talk. They're not going to BS you. And on top of it, most, not all, but most of them are pretty darn humble, and that's important to me. Because humility, if I can give you guys one bit of advice, and I mean it sincerely, nobody knows this, but two younger ones, you know, if I can give you one bit of advice is, you know, journey continues, just always, always remain humble. That's real important because people will always respect you the most for that. And they will also not threaten in any way or form because I look at it this way. I'm a facilitator. I think we all are. I'm a product of, I can't tell you how many folks over the years I've learned from, videos, courses, lectures, you name it. And so it's a hybridization of so much, so many different sources that I'm more or less just packaging this and passing the baton on. That's how I see it. I'm a facilitator. Call me an educator, sure, but I see my stuff more of like that facilitator kind of concept. And it really boils down to humility, because if you're humble about things, people will listen to you more. Nobody likes an arrogant, pardon me, asshole. Nobody does. Yeah. And yet that happens. We all know it. And we know who they are.
Even if they're good, you don't care. You're like, no.
Exactly. It's a turnoff. Let's face it.
It is a turnoff for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. So to make a real short story long, I pick and choose these folks because of those qualities that they have. And of course, it goes without saying they've got great knowledge of their a great handle of what they can talk on, but they're also going to be practical about it too. And I make sure they're not going to get crazy and show too much research and in science and histo and all that. Just enough to be evidence based, yes, but again, clinically relevant. Mm-hmm. We all are in the same boat. That's right. The key.
Yeah, and you're right. Nobody there went all into the research. They quoted their stuff. They backed up their paper, their work, but nobody was just crazy. That way, everybody was showing, the legit stuff. And
exactly.
You had rock stars in their field. I mean, I was just blown away. I mean, they were entertaining. They were funny. I mean, I can't wait to February.
Who impressed you the most?
I knew that was going to come up. Dr. Urban was, it was like, wow. I liked the guy that did all the digital stuff there at the end, Dr. Bacellos, on Saturday.
That was Dr. Teixeira. Yes. And Barbosa, Dr. Teixeira Barbosa. Yeah, he does some beautiful work. Yes.
And then the guy right before the third one on Saturday did all the soft tissue grafting. Oh, my gosh.
Dr. Zakeli was?
I'm ready. I can't wait to come back and do a graft now. Who can I do that on?
I love it. He calls me on the plane. It's like, you won't believe it. Like, oh, gosh. He's got books. I was like, how much stuff did you buy?
packages will start showing up here in the next couple of days.
You know, he pulls out this bone grinder thing. I was like, Dad, we have this bone harvester right here that we bought last time. I was like, we got more trinkets and stuff. But, hey, I love it.
That was kind of cool, too, because I saw what Dr. Urban does with xenograft. In my mind, I'm going, well, if I take the autograft and mix it with my cadaver bone, I've got like two superpowers now, not just one.
I love it.
This makes total sense.
Then you could use a BMP and have three superpowers.
That's right. You throw a BMP in there. Now, while we're talking about materials, what is your material that you're on right now? You're loving it. It's coming. You're super excited. Give us a little, what's the Dr. Picos material of the day?
Sure, I can tell you the one that's coming down the pike, the one coming down the pike that it's probably a couple years out, I'm guessing still, but will be happening, I believe, within this 2-year time frame. So you'll definitely be able to be part of it. And that's a material called tetranite. It's a... it's going to be sold most likely as a bone adhesive, but also as a grafting material to follow. And in a nutshell, it's basically technology taken from a sea worm, of all things. I mean, how do barnacles basically get locked onto a piling? And you can't get them off with it unless you have a crowbar, you know? Think about it. That adhesive element is pretty much at the heart of what this technology is about. And there's a company called Launchpad that, and I'll just, be right up front as always, I'm transparent with everything. You know, I am part of their advisory board and also I'm going to be involved with most likely the human research coming up, because dog studies have been completed now. And what they're able to do, what we're able to show nicely, is that you can actually place an implant. Well, let me back up. The real neat thing is, and Rick, you saw the video I showed.
Yes.
At the symposium, and Rick Myron, I think, showed it as well. And that is taking a femur, a cow femur, cutting it tangentially, right? Picture that now. Mm-hmm. It's cut in two. And you take this powder liquid, mix it together over a period of about 3-4 minutes. It becomes a nice little putty. And you literally apply it like a paste, more or less, on one surface of the cut aspect of the bone. And then piece the two sections together and let it sit for in some water, ideally some saline rather, for about 10 minutes. Okay. And then these two pulleys are shown trying to attempt to pull these two segments apart.
Wow.
At 50, 100, 150, 200, 300 pounds per square inch. And this bone isn't budging. Wow. Okay. Now, apply that to placing an implant, which only in dogs has it been done so far. But an implant in barely a millimeter of bone. In other words, it's pretty much just hanging there in space. You inject this adhesive around it, this bone cement, so to speak, right? And let that set up. And within 10, 15 minutes, pull-out torque is 60 newton centimeters. 6-0. 6-0. Now, talk about a game changer. Think about it. Like you'll be able to inject this material.
Implant Gorilla Glue.
I mean,
tetranite is a cool name, though.
Yeah, it is. Tetranite. And
now, bone interface contact, kind of like studies with the dogs. Have they done that?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the histology is amazing. And Rick Myron wrote a beautiful chapter on it. And that's in his new book, by the way, which I really don't mind promoting and putting in a plug for. You know, his biomaterials, Next Generation.
Yes.
It's a definite.
That's the book I forgot to buy.
I remember
now. Next generation.
Yeah, it's next generation biomaterials. It's fantastic. He's got a whole book chapter on tetranite. You want to read it because histology is amazing. At 6, 10, 15, 30 weeks out, it'll blow your mind as to how the substitution is going on with that bone interface. In other words, that material, you want to make sure it's resorbing, and in fact, it is. And that's important for all of us, of course. And so, again, human studies have to be done. So, you know, pilot and pivotal, you know, we'll be following soon. And then it's going to be available, of course. So, exciting.
That is exciting. Cool. That's something that I actually want to look into this. Because honestly, think about it. Instead of using tacks and all these suture fixation screws and all that crap,
you could just stick it there.
Like a wall. Like put some wall and that's your onlay grafting. Whoopsie. Like in the next.
And run.
You know, like there are some materials like they talk about it. But honestly, I have not played around with something that is decent. Everything that I played with that kind of like where you just put it there, it's going to happen.
All the putty matrices and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't like them, but this is something it looks like. But the problem with most of these, Dr. Picos, is I think a lot of it is it comes down to being biased from the company as well, because most of these studies sometimes covers up the dog studies, but not human. And also, in order to do human, it's hard because how are you going to take that implant out after you put it in order to see how much bone implant interface you have or all the histology? Right. So it's so hard to see these bone grafting companies because every one of them comes next day and says, this is why we're different. And sure. You're like, well, so how can you...
What do you believe? Yeah. Well, the good news is on some of these studies, quite honestly, and it's ironic because in Europe, you know, they can't use cadaver bone, but what's interesting is there's some amazing human quote unquote studies that are done because these volunteers quote unquote paid appropriately will allow you to literally go in and take a couple, three teeth out, put some graft material in there, or better yet, even do almost an en bloc resection. In going back to retrieve, let's say a grafted site, and yet you know they can do it, but obviously we would get slaughtered if we did that in the States. So there's a lot of irony and you know paradox to the whole you know the whole thing in terms of the discussion of who can use what where and what continent. So bottom line is these studies will be done overseas to start. They have to be in order to get quick, you know, approval and most importantly, the results histologically, et cetera, and then come to the States. That's really going to be the order.
That's exciting. Well, thanks for sharing it with us. And thanks for sharing your time. I know you're super busy with all the schedule and you're still over at the office, which is, what time is it?
It's 7 there. It's about time to get him home.
Yeah.
And we wish you thank you. I appreciate being part of this very much. And I'm impressed with all three of you, you know, you're committed to excellence, absolutely, because you're proof of concept with taking the courses that are in your career, continue to learn to push the envelope. I admire that, and I could see more of that. I would love to see more of that throughout our entire country because, you know, the millennial generation is a very impressive one. And if you're in Simon Sinek at all, you can understand and appreciate better, you know, what this beautiful group is all about. And the nurturing that it would take to understand and to promote the growth of our young folks. So I give kudos to you, Rick. I mean, gosh, at your age especially, that's fantastic. You know, I can't say enough about your enthusiasm. Each time you're here at the Institute, you know, you just exude that and that just enthusiasm, and everybody kind of just plays off of you. I mean, you're an amazing guy. All three of you, again. Kudos. Thank you.
Well, Doc, thank you. We really, really appreciate that. And you know, I know that for Paymon and I, that's definitely something that, you know, I think part of our big goal in this podcast, all this stuff is we want to, we agree with you. And we think that the millennial generation does have a lot to offer. And we do have a lot of cool things that we can do. And our goal, I think, is to really lean on y'all and rewrite the script for us.
Especially with Dr. Picos and some of the people, like there are very few people like him that they are very connected even with at that age or after all of that work, looking back, that they're still connected with the millennials.
Yeah. That's what you have two children who are millennials.
Yes.
Your daughter and your son. So you totally get it.
And they're probably studs, if I would imagine.
Good old millennials.
Yeah, the one, they got a little pressure.
I bet, look, think about this. Like, if they were in school, all their professors, like, know they're that, like, hey. Yeah. Like, how's that feeling, like, going to school, like, knowing, hey, if you don't give me an A on that paper.
Well, actually, quite the contrary. My poor daughter, when she was up at Chapel Hill in dental school, she did everything in her power to keep a low profile. And I'll never forget one of her restorative instructors first year. Don't you know, he kind of came by and took a look at her and saw the name and made a comment and said something like, the effect that, you realize your dad is a pretty famous guy. And she just, I'm sure, flushed immediately, gets on the phone, screams at my wife, you know, kind of crying and all. Diane tells me, I'm not supposed to know this, right? So next chance I had, I call Lindsay. Hey, how's it going, honey? How's school, this and that? Oh, good, Dad, he's good. I said, by the way, did you know something? She goes, what? I said, your dad's a pretty famous guy. She's all, pardon me, pissed off, like, what? How did you know that? You know, blah, blah, blah. So each kid really in their own way, they've done their own thing, and God love them. They're good. They're great kids. They're old school. I love that term, old school. That's what you are to me, as I see you too. You know, out of 10 of these, you know, younger group, these millennials, as we call them, sure, there's maybe a couple, three that are old school, meaning the core values are there, they respect them, and the rest of them need to understand them, because if they don't, it's going to be a tough life. Yeah. And you guys are raised the proper way. And I know you, Payman, with your mom, I know that story. It's a beautiful one. And I'll tell you what, and you know, Sully, there's your dad right there. I mean, there's the, you know, and I'm sure your mom is equally, played equally a huge role in your upbringing. But my point is, you guys are blessed with those core values. Continue to work with those and within those, and don't ever change. Don't ever change. That's so important. And humility is one of the key core values that I mentioned earlier. Just maintain that. You'll always be successful because you have the work ethic. That's huge. That's huge. And that's what we try to instill in our kids. And that's why I do consider both of ours, you know, old school. They have respect for the elderly, et cetera, et cetera. Nobody's perfect. But when you see that, you automatically kind of you're drawn to them. And that's how you folks are. And I admire that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. Thank you so much. Yeah, we would love to do this again at some point. Sure. This has been a blast and an honor for sure. And we'll definitely have to
stay in touch. Contacts for people that like to submit to the symposium for the courses.
How can people get in touch with you if they want to find out more about courses or whatnot?
Well, it's simple. Just go online. They can go online. Picos Institute. Yeah, gotcha. Real simple. And we have everything pretty much on there. Our courses and certainly the symposium, etc. But again, there are many courses to take throughout the country, throughout the world. And I would encourage, you know, everybody to take advantage of the folks that are offering them everywhere. There's so many neat sources and individuals to learn from. It's an ongoing journey again for all of us. But I thank you, the three of you, for this opportunity. It's been fun. I have enjoyed it, and I would look forward to doing it again.
Well, definitely.
Thank you so much.
I'll see you in a couple months.
Yes. I know. I'll take it back to you too. So we'll make it happen.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening. And everybody remember, work smarter, not harder.
Thank you for listening to The Millennial Dentist. Visit us online at millennialdentist.com.